Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. A quick reminder before we get started, any advice provided by Brandon is general and does not consider your financial situation, needs, or objectives, so consider whether it's appropriate for you. Brandon van der Kolk is authorized to provide general financial product advice in Australia and is authorized representative number 1305795 of Guideway Financial Services Proprietary Limited, AFSL number 420367. Please see the description box for Brandon's financial services guide. Past performance is not a reliable indication of future investment returns. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Hey, Mishota, how you going, mate?
What's cracking? Well. I'm going well. Just doing the last video for the year, getting it prepared.
Yeah.
Before I take a little bit of a break, go on a bit of a holiday, which is exciting, always nice.
Do people have to wait and see what the video is going to be about, or can we talk about it?
They can wait and see. It's probably out, actually. Wait. I would probably assume it'll be out by the time this goes out, maybe, depending how hard I work today on the edit that I have in front of me. But I guess I can just say, I'm doing like an overall sort of short 6-7 minute recap video of all of the big finance stories and economic stories of 2023, so...
It's like the good old days of YouTube Rewind. Do you remember that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, everyone does that now. Like you have like Spotify Wrapped and you have YouTube does their like creator wrapped sort of thing. Everyone has their kind of recap for 2023. And I think people just kind of like that sort of thing just to kind of put everything together in a box. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I'm very interested to see what you come up with. And then you're off on holidays, right?
Yeah. I'm going to South Korea, for a week for New Year's. So it's going to be cold. I think I was checking the weather the other day and it was like a top of -5 and a low of -15. So, it's cold. We don't get too many, cold, like, Christmas, New Year's kind of periods in Australia, so
absolutely never.
Yeah, nice to nice change of pace. I think it'll be exciting. Yeah,
yeah. And you've not been to South Korea before? I've never.
No, I haven't before. No. I don't know what to expect. We'll see. What about?
Oh, you know what they say, Hamish? South Korea's got soul.
Wow. And that's the end of the episode, guys. We'll just wrap it up.
I was like, where am I going to fit in my South Korea's Got Soul joke?
Oh boy. So what have you got going on?
Not a lot. I'm a bit tired today because I just got back from Perth. I've kind of already had a week of downtime. So I'm kind of getting back into it in a way. The boys are off on holidays now, so it's just me in the office, but I got to start preparing all the kind of January content for next year. So that'll happen. I might give myself a little break actually over Christmas and Boxing Day, maybe watch a little bit of cricket. But then before New Year's, I think I'll be slaving away, getting the content ready for next year. I just came back from a nice little trip to Perth. I tried flight boarding, which is kind of cool. It's like a self-propelled surfboard, but it's got the, what are they called? Like hydrofoils where you kind of start to float up in the air. It's so much fun.
That looks hard.
I had such a good time.
Did you fall off a bunch of times? I feel like I would.
Oh, yeah.
I'm terribly uncoordinated. I feel like I would be terrible at that.
The way I summed it up to the instructor is I've never had so much fun just being pelted by water for an hour. Like you just eat it constantly. You're just off, slap, straight into the water. But it is fun. And you do pick it up. I was just trying to do crazy stuff like carve like tight corners and stuff and jumps and things like that. But no, it's good fun. I do recommend it. If you ever have the chance to go flight boarding, it's very, very fun. Mm. But yes, Hamish, we have a podcast to do today, don't we?
We
so
do.
What are we talking about today, mate?
Yeah, we've got, I thought we'd do a little bit of a media recap. We've got the top 10 highest grossing films of 2023 globally. We'll go through that.
Oh, okay.
And there's actually some spicy news in the media merger acquisition landscape that we'll talk about.
I think I saw something about that. Anyway, I won't spoil it now, but yes, it does sound very interesting. Mm. Huge if true.
Yeah, huge if true. We've also got a survey of consumer finances from the Federal Reserve, which had some interesting data. And what have you got for us?
I have chucked in a little thing. Rudy Giuliani is filing for bankruptcy, so that's interesting. Yeah, but more interesting, the thing that I've been interested in is that the Red Sea, well, it's a sad story. The Red Sea is in a bit of crisis with some rebels, but the economic flow and effects of a passage like that, you know, getting shut down or shipping being redirected is actually quite drastic. So right. I'll talk about that as well. And hopefully we can do some Q&A as well. We'll see how we go. Hopefully we've got some time at the end.
All right. Well, with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks. View buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings, and manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days. All right. Where should we begin? Do you want to tell us tell us about this Red Sea crisis?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So the Red Sea is the area in question. And the Red Sea is important. Well, that whole area, it's just a massive shipping corridor. Because if you think of the world map, the Red Sea and then the Suez connects to the Suez Canal, which then connects to the Mediterranean. So it's a really major shipping lane for connecting Europe and Asia, which is obviously a very big deal. So unfortunately, Houthi rebels in Yemen have significantly stepped up attacks on commercial shipping vessels traveling through the lower Red Sea since mid-November in response to Israel's bombardment of Gaza. On some occasion, Houthis have boarded or sought to board merchant tankers. On others, they have targeted cargo ships with drones and missiles. Damage has been minimal in most cases, but in mid-November, one tanker, the Galaxy Leader, was successfully hijacked. So threats have escalated further in the past week to a point where Maersk, MSC, and other shipping groups have halted or rerouted traffic, while the US has announced a maritime coalition to defend against shipping attacks. So it's causing a, you remember how that boat got stuck in the Suez Canal?
Yep.
How it kind of, and you remember that just the, how one little boat, well, it was a big boat, but one boat getting stuck in this canal caused like major turmoil throughout the whole world. It's kind of a similar situation. Granted, it's different. Obviously, these are rebels attacking ships and trying to hijack ships going through that area.
Yeah.
But it has that same kind of effect where it really chokes that shipping lane, or it affects that shipping lane, and then the whole rest of like global trade, but well, particularly between Asia and Europe, is just completely messed up. So. It's a big deal.
Yeah. This is like the whole like modern day, this is probably a part, I guess, of the modern day piracy kind of stuff, right? Where I think for the last, I think recently it's been a lot better. But for a long time, there's been these periods where, ships are just getting hijacked and people taken hostage for ransom. And it tends to take place through these kind of narrow choke points of supply chains.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's the thing. Yeah, this is a bottleneck. It's a choke point. And you would imagine that you, at all costs, you know, there would be a lot of countries working together to ensure the that this lane, this shipping lane, is 100% safe, like, all the time.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, if something goes wrong, then it's big trouble, as we are seeing. I've got here around 30% of global trade passes through the Suez Canal and the Red Sea.
Wow, that's a crazy stat. That's insane.
That's a lot. That's a lot of cargo. And as I was saying, you know, you would imagine that they would protect this lane. Well, on Monday, the US has announced that it had assembled a coalition of countries who had agreed to carry out patrols in the southern Red Sea to try and safeguard vessels against attacks. The coalition, called Operation Prosperity Guardian, includes the UK, Bahrain, Canada, France, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Spain, and Hamish, help me out. How do you pronounce that one?
You're on your own there.
Seychelles. I don't even know how to say that. Damn, I'm probably butchering. Anyway, prominent shipping companies, including Maersk, Hapag-Lloyd, and MSC, have decided not to use the Red Sea over the past week. According to the Atlantic Council, a think tank, 7 out of the 10 biggest shipping companies by market share have suspended operations in the Red Sea.
Wow.
So instead of cutting through the Red Sea, up through the Suez Canal, and into the Mediterranean, they are now going down and around Africa.
Wow. Yeah,
so it's a big detour. So they're now going through what they call the Cape of Good Hope route, which is in South Africa. And they say going through that route actually reduces an Asia-Europe's trip effective capacity by 25%, according to UBS.
Wow.
So you take quite a hit.
Yeah, I wonder, like, yeah, I wonder how that, because that's got to ripple out significantly across the supply chain. So I wonder, is this a brand new story, or has this kind of been developing over a, how recent is this? Is this this week?
It's been since mid-November. But right. I think in the last week it's gotten a lot worse.
Right.
Or people have, you know, higher ups have decided to take action. But you're exactly right. And that's why, you know, I don't really like reporting on stories where it's like just conflict this, conflict that. We didn't really cover too much of the war in Ukraine just because it's kind of just conflict. Like, we don't really talk about Israel, Gaza, that kind of stuff, because it's just conflict. But when it has this massive economic impact, it's sad, but it is still quite interesting to kind of take a look at and try and break down.
Yeah.
So it is kind of interesting, even some of the flow-on effects, like global logistics managers are faced with a two-front storm of rising ocean and air freight prices and also stranded cargo. Both are threats to the global supply chain after three tumultuous years of inflationary pressures and delays from COVID disruptions, which recently seem to have finally been vanquished. The ceiling in ocean freight prices shot up in a matter of hours on Thursday as a result of more vessels diverting from the Red Sea. CNBC has learned that logistics managers were quoted this morning an ocean freight rate of $10,000 per 40-foot container from Shanghai to the UK. Last week, so $10,000. Last week, rates were $1,900 USD for a 20-foot container to $2,400 for a 40-foot container.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's a reasonable jump. It's a reasonable jump. They also say truck rates in the Middle East now being quoted more than double what they were.
Wow.
So,
geez, that's like a 4x in the price of a shipping container in just immediately is crazy.
25% reduction in efficiency having to go around Africa. So it makes sense for this coalition of countries just to come in and try and bolster up this area.
Yeah.
Make sure that shipping is safe so that, if you're getting the biggest shipping companies in the world going, hey, whoa, man, we're not going through there right now. We don't want to lose our cargo. We don't want to lose our captains of these big vessels. You know, we don't want to get hijacked. We don't want to lose these boats.
Yeah.
Then, fair enough that pretty quickly you have major countries stepping in to try and secure the area.
Yeah. There's nothing really more you can do, I think, beyond actually getting support from different countries, I guess. I was trying to think back. I did watch a video on modern day piracy a little while ago from Johnny Harris, who had a really good video on it. And I think he was saying that they began, all the shipping companies started to go, like, have schedules when they would go through the canal together. So they would be kind of going through together rather than being isolated by a piracy just kind of coming up and just jumping on board. But yeah, it seems like it's a difficult kind of problem. And it often stems, I guess, from the economic situations of the poorer countries along those canals, right? Like, they're looking for, at least maybe not in this case, but at least when it comes to piracy, like, it's a way of making money you know, the government doesn't have, like, a good system for you in your country.
Yeah.
So, you know, just
going
and robbing shipping containers is like or taking hostages and getting ransoms is actually a, you know, just a viable option. Given the situation. So
that's why I'm never quick to judge people, even for things like, you know, stealing, just generally, like, because a lot of the times people don't want to steal. A lot of the times they have to steal because it's either steal or don't eat kind of thing. So it is a complex issue, and I'm certainly not going to stand up here and say that I'm an expert in the matter, nor do I know how to solve it. But it is an interesting situation that causes a strong kind of ripple effect in the broader economy.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Awesome.
Anyway, so yeah, that's what's happening in the Red Sea.
All right.
We'll see what happens there. But you want to talk about something a little bit happier.
Yeah, on a slightly lighter note, let's talk about movies. Yeah.
All right.
Let's talk about fake violence.
Fabrication.
Scripted violence. Oh, no, so I thought we could take a look at the top 10 grossing films of 2023. I saw a couple of movies this year, but
me too, actually.
I was looking through this list and I haven't seen most of them on the list, so which I guess is generally the case. I think a lot of these top 10s are always going to be probably movies that are either Marvel, which I'm not a Marvel person, or movies that are directed towards more of a kid family audience. So we've got our top 10 from global box office results. Coming in at number 10, Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania. Have you seen that? Seen that movie?
No, I thought it was a flop. I thought it was a big flop. Still 10th on the list.
That's the funny thing. Like, some of the names on here, I swear I saw so much commentary about them being flops, and they still made hundreds of millions of dollars. So coming in at number 10, $476.3 million in worldwide box office sales. And that one, of course, is a Marvel, produced by Marvel Studios and distributed by Disney. Elemental came in at number 9, Pixar Animation, $479.8 million in global box office revenue. Number 8 was Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, produced by Skydance and TC Productions, Tom Cruise's production company, $567.5 million. So produced by Tom Cruise's own company, and then, of course, distributed by Paramount, so they kind of work in partnership, and Skydance for a number, I think since 2009, has had kind of this kind of co-production partnership with Paramount Pictures. So they kind of consistently work together on projects. Another movie I didn't see. I did see a lot of that Jump, though. That was that movie with the
was it?
The ramp, I guess, right?
Yeah, I guess, and the parachute.
Yeah, and they just dumped all their marketing into that one.
Into that one 5-second sequence. Come watch this movie just for this jump. Whoa.
Yeah. Imagine the cheer when that went off. Woo! In the theater.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, it's pretty weird when that's true now that I think about it. The only marketing I saw of that movie was Tom Cruise doing that jump.
Yeah, I have no idea what the movie, like any clues about the plot or anything. I didn't even see a trailer that had anything beyond Tom Cruise bravely taking a ramp off a mountain.
Dear oh dear, good on you, Tom.
Number 7, The Little Mermaid came in $568.8 million. The box office, massive
hit.
Oh,
was that the one that was getting torn to shreds?
Yeah, I think, this is kind of another one on the list where people were saying, oh, this is going to bomb and, you know, this is controversial, all this stuff. And it's, it ends up doing $600 million at the box office. So You know, that,
yeah, so weird.
I think, you know, Walt Disney has had some pretty bad movies in the last couple of years, but that wasn't one of them. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to look at the quick Rotten Tomatoes rating, but it looks, I'm not sure if, I've gotten the right one here. 94% of people watching the movie liked it. 67% on Rotten Tomatoes. There you go.
Yeah. All right, coming in at number six, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. That's the other thing. I think all of these big movies now, they're all a part of like these like cinematic universes. Like they're all. I saw an interesting video about this theory that big film studios just want to make sequels now. So the way that they can just make everything a sequel is just by creating these universes or just focusing in on these universes and then just continuing to just make movies because they generally do reasonably well. And it's just funny to see that it's not even just Marvel doing that anymore. It's, you know, who is this? This is this is Marvel, but it's also Sony and Columbia. And now Spider-Man is a multiverse. It's like they're all doing it. Because I guess it
works.
But
that one, that one's the animated one. Is that right?
Oh, is it? Oh, is it? Okay.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure actually. I'll quickly look it up. But they've got it's so weird, but like Spider-Man's one of those things where it's got like I think this one is the animated one. Yeah, Across the Spider-Verse. But it's like it's got like the live action universe of Spider-Man, and then it's got like the cartoon version of Spider-Man, and that's got its own universe.
Yeah.
I don't get it anymore, man. It's too much to keep up with.
Yeah.
It's too much.
It's a lot. But anyway, it made $684.9 million at the box office, so we're going to continue to get more of that. Fast and Furious 10. Oh. What a classic.
Have you seen that? Me and Claude has a great laugh in the office. You seen that, the scene with Vin Diesel and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, where it's like at the end of the movie, and they're like talking to each other, and they're kind of standing, they're standing to one another's side and then talking like ahead, but not, they're like talking to each other, but not looking at each other. They're standing by and they're looking ahead.
Yeah.
but the way, the angle that it's filmed at, I think it makes one of them, I can't remember who, makes them look like absolutely ginormous. It is so funny. It's such like an optical illusion. That it's such a meme. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. I totally derailed you there.
That's funny. I wonder how many movies they're going to make in that series before it ends. Like, do you reckon they get to 20? Do they get to 20?
Yeah, true. Like, yeah, I don't know, actually.
That's
so funny.
There's another funny video on Fast and Furious and their stunt inflation throughout the series, throughout the different movies.
Really?
Like the first series, the first movie, I think the biggest stunt is like, I don't know, the car goes in the air a little bit and he gets a scratch on his face. And then by the 10th movie, like there's explosions, there's aeroplanes, there's all kinds of stuff going on. It's just funny. Yeah. Like they have to just every year just find a bigger, some kind of bigger like stunt that they could do to top the last year.
Like what's the one in Fast 20 will be like the Earth exploding.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like I don't know, some rocket ship ride to space and then the Earth explodes.
They'll be in like time machines. Like
Yeah,
it'll be a multiverse.
Sucked into a black hole and spat out again. Yeah, the multiverse, the fast 20 multiverse announcement.
Yeah.
You should check on your Facebook. I just sent you the picture that I was talking about.
Okay,
it's Dwayne The Rock Johnson that looks absolutely huge.
That's great. That's fantastic.
How silly does that look?
That's ridiculous.
They didn't. Wow. Surely someone must have said something when they filmed that. Anyway.
It doesn't matter because they made $707.6 million at the box office. That one by Universal. So well done. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 by Marvel again, $845.4 million at the box office. Here's one that I saw, Oppenheimer, produced by Syncopy and Atlas
Finally
Entertainment.
Finally a good movie on the list.
I know. Well, yeah, we've only got three left. distributed by Universal, $951.4 million at the box office. Or just shy of a billion dollars.
Wow.
Unfortunately.
That did pretty well.
Yeah. Considering it was, it's kind of a niche topic, I guess. But I mean, it's Christopher Nolan, so I guess it makes sense that it would do really, really well. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. But I wouldn't have.
I thought it was great. I would be. I've seen it twice.
I'm surprised that it's number three on the list. That it had. It also got such a wide audience, which you know, doesn't often happen with those kinds of movies.
Yeah. No, it's a really good movie. If you haven't seen it, go and see it. It's fantastic. It's actually like, I don't know, like what you said before, these other ones are just like, oh, let's go and see the latest Fast and Furious movie. Oh, let's go and see the latest Marvel movie.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just like, just a standalone good movie.
Yeah, I wonder how much of a role, like, if it's like a kid's audience movie, like, and parents are going with the kid, I wonder how much of a impact that has on box office results. Like, you're buying two tickets instead of one. I guess not really. I guess the kid's ticket's probably quite cheap. So it's probably
not. Even still. Yeah, I don't know. Normally you see like rows of kids though. Like,
true.
One, like, yeah, a couple of adults will take
that's
like
true.
10 kids or something.
That's
like.
That is true. Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Number two, though, is another probably kids-oriented movie. It's the Super Mario Brothers movie. Produced by Universal, Illumination, and Nintendo. Did $1.34 billion globally.
What?
And yeah, I actually watched it.
That's crazy.
I watched it a couple of months ago. It's actually pretty good.
Is it?
Yeah. It's just like a constant movie of callbacks to the game. Like, so I think that was the criticism from some people, was it's just like, it's overly like nostalgia baiting in a way.
Right.
But I thought it was quite good. And it's a kid's, like the story, you know, there's no crazy twist, like, you know. Like, Mario doesn't pull off a mask at the end and he's, you know, he's a villain or something, or like, you know, this isn't the Joker, but I thought it was, I thought it was pretty good.
Okay, nice. Yeah, there you go. I probably won't see it because I never played Mario as a kid.
Oh,
I never had any Nintendo consoles.
Wow, really? I think, I was mostly on Nintendo consoles. I had was it Game Boy Nintendo? No, I guess not. But they had a lot of Nintendo games on it. I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure it was.
But I had a DS, and then I had a Wii.
Yeah, it's Game Boy is Nintendo.
Yeah, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think I've definitely had more Nintendo consoles than anything else. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my parents never let me play video games when I was a kid. It was until...
Oh, really?
I remember I got a PlayStation 2 for Christmas one year when I was, would have been in maybe late primary school, and that just blew my mind. I could not believe that my parents had bought a PlayStation console for me. I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But yeah, I never had any of the handheld ones, and I never had the Nintendo 64, or I never had a Wii, or I never had a Game Boy. I never had a...
I do have
What was the
I do have
later
a Nintendo
one? DS?
64, though. Yeah. Yeah, DS. Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
That was like my main... Is it a Nintendo? No, I have a... What's the older one? The older Nintendo console?
I don't know.
Anyway, I have one of them. Anyway. Anyway, yeah, $1.34 cool. billion. And number one, of course, was Barbie. Heyday Films, Lucky Chap Entertainment, NBGG Films, and Mattel. $1.44 billion at the box office. So congratulations, Barbie.
Wow. Yeah, that's well done, Margot Robbie, really. Because that was not even just for acting, but she's a producer on that film. She's the one that kind of got that film made. She was the like creative driving force. She was the producer of that film. She organized getting the director. She helped out. Obviously, she said that she would have been happy not playing Barbie, but the director that she chose wanted Margot to be Barbie. But yeah, she wanted to. She loved the franchise. She wanted to get the film made. She pulled it off, and it was a crazy, crazy phenomenon. It was interesting. I thought the movie was just like mid, you know. I didn't really like it's just a movie, like,
yeah.
Oppenheimer, but maybe this just goes down to personal taste, like Oppenheimer is a really great story and great film,
yeah,
told in a really compelling way, and quite suspenseful,
yeah.
But Barbie was just like, I don't know, maybe it just benefited from the kid factor as well. But it's just like a it's a generic story.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, anyway. that's most of this list. I'm actually extremely surprised that Oppenheimer is even on this list. I think probably a big part of it was the whole, just because of, I mean, look at the other names here. I mean, all of them are all just, they're all very wide audience. Like
franchise-y.
I think Oppenheimer was a thriller, right? And it's a very specific kind of story, and it's, you know, it's, I don't know. I'm just surprised that it is among some of these names, but
Yeah.
There you go. And then in terms of the industry for 2023, so Gower Street analytics firm is projecting $31.5 billion in global box office sales for the year. So that projection was made based on the latest data last week, which is less than expected at the start of the year, but is more than 2022. So expected this year, $31.5 billion. Last year was $25.9 billion. 2021 was $21.3 billion. But get this, pre-COVID 2019 was $42.3 billion. So even in 2023, with some of these massive hits, with the whole Barbenheimer, or that whole free publicity that blew up all over social media, even with that, they're still lagging by about 25% behind pre-COVID levels, which is kind of crazy, because my thought would have been that there would have been this huge pent-up demand for cinema after COVID, and you would have seen an overshoot to come back to normal levels, but that hasn't really happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't quite know why that is, but I mean, there's obviously COVID caused a change in the way that we consume movies. There's now many more options in terms of streaming services, and even the big, you know, distributors have their own streaming services. Yeah. So there's that factor, I guess. But I think a lot of the kind of 2019 era of movie success was definitely led by cultural phenomenons in the Marvel franchise, kind of culminating. Star Wars as well. There were still Star Wars movies in the cinema around that time.
Yeah.
So I think that definitely has a big helping hand, whereas now kind of post-COVID, all that's just been switched more to television, because it was an easier format to get the media to people during lockdowns.
Yeah. It's difficult to say. I don't know.
That's kind of like my hypothesis, but yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's possible that COVID maybe accelerated this kind of shift from going out to kind of staying in. Like maybe people who, you know, maybe wouldn't watch too many movies at home during COVID started doing so and found that they kind of enjoyed doing it. Maybe there's an element of that. It's hard to say. Certainly there's more, you know, content you can consume at home now. And I think that has accelerated over the last couple of years, but that's also been around for a while. I mean, if you wanted to wait for a movie to watch it at home, you've been able to do that for quite some time. So yeah, it is confusing that it's so dramatically different. Like if you look year to year before COVID, there are ups and downs, depending on what movies come out and the popularity of those movies, but there's certainly never a 25% swing. It's like a 5% swing at most between year to year. So there definitely is something happening that I think is around either the slate of films that have come out or the COVID kind of hangover or the streaming industry growing. There's certainly something happening.
Indeed, indeed, Hamish. Should we keep on, is that all you had to say about the kind of movie industry? Should we keep cracking on to this media merger?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. We can stay in media. Yeah. This just happened.
While we're here.
This just happened just a couple of days ago. Which is kind of funny because last week we were talking about all of our predictions. If you haven't seen that episode, we went through all of our predictions that we made last year. And one of the predictions was, will there be a big media merger? I actually said there would be, and we didn't see one, of course, and we won't see one in the last 10 days unless we get the fastest merger of all time that happens. But maybe we're going to see one in 2024. Maybe I was just a year early. This week, Warner Brothers Discovery held talks with Paramount Global this week to discuss a potential merger, according to people familiar with the matter. The merger talks seem to represent the challenge traditional media companies have competing in streaming with newer tech giants. So you have kind of Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, all with very deep pockets to and going out and buying movies rights, TV shows, producing their own movies and TV shows, buying sports rights. Whereas a lot of these traditional media companies have these massive debt burdens from previous mergers or acquisitions. Warner Brothers has $45 billion in debt. Paramount has $15 billion in debt, and neither of them have a profitable streaming business yet. So it's been a really tough last couple of years, and it's going to be a tough next couple of years, which is why we're now seeing some of these businesses get into talks of potentially coming together and working together. The talks also raise questions about whether Warner Brothers would ever merge with Comcast subsidiary NBC Universal. So that also just kind of came up in the news as whether that merger would be possible as well. Although it seems like that merger would probably be less likely to happen just because of the regulatory issues that might face, because Warner Brothers and Universal are the two biggest movie studios by revenue. So that would be that'd be regulators allowing the two biggest movie studios to combine into this gigantic movie studio that's, you know, significantly bigger than anyone nearby. So that might kind of have regulatory issues. And both of those companies also own two massive cable news networks, CNN owned by Warner Brothers and MSNBC owned by Comcast. So combining the two out of the three biggest cable news networks could also be an issue.
Could be challenging.
And then the last combination, which you can just kind of consider all three combinations, Comcast and Paramount merging, according to the Wall Street Journal, that would probably never be possible just because they both own broadcast networks. They both own free-to-air networks, so regulators would be unlikely to allow two of those free-to-air networks to join together.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So it looks, So what do you think is most likely?
I have no idea. Here's the other thing about the news. I mean, obviously both Warner Brothers and Paramount declined to comment about the meetings, and it's just
a bit of a rumor-ish.
It's pure speculation at this point.
Right.
There's really nothing on paper. I think it can make sense for some of these businesses to combine. I think it also would make sense, and I haven't seen too much of this yet, but these big media companies, they have massive libraries of content, a lot of it, which I'm sure has value that's just not being kind of accessed through their streaming services or licensing deals. I wonder if we'll see them sell off, you know, parts of their content, you know, like selling off something like their Nickelodeon, spinning off the Nickelodeon network, which is kind of a dying part of their cable business. There's probably some assets in there that they can sell off and generate some cash flow, but yeah, it is certainly tricky. They've got a lot of debt and they need to figure out how to get to scale in streaming. And this is one of the ways that they think maybe they can do it.
Streaming has definitely proved to be difficult. I don't know. I wouldn't have thought it would be that difficult to make money in streaming.
I think the difficult part is you've got these media companies coming from a situation where they were able to get a lot of money out of customers. Like, it was a very inefficient market where you had to pay $100 a month to buy a bunch of channels that you didn't want. And streaming has allowed, even though you can argue that that's kind of happening now with streaming, but at least you can be a little bit more selective. You know, you can just spend $15 on entertainment if you want. You just buy Netflix or you just buy Disney Plus. Whereas before it was you pay $100 a month and you might barely watch anything. You might watch one channel. So I think the industry has been able to collect a lot of revenue from customers that was just an inefficient, poor value proposition for the customer. And I think that's the tricky thing that they're grappling with is, yeah, they can set up a streaming service, but they're only going to collect, you know, $15, $20 per month from those customers rather than, you know, these enormous affiliate fees and ads that they've been able to collect for, you know, since the 80s.
Which is good for the consumer. Definitely works for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, it makes it much more difficult for these big companies, doesn't it?
Yep. Yep. That's for sure. Yeah. And that's it. That's all I had. That's our media wrap up.
All right. Nice. Well, watch this space. Let's move on and talk about good old Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, no.
Love him, hate him. But Rudy Giuliani filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in New York on Thursday, citing debts that include nearly $150 million in a recent civil judgment for defaming two Georgia election workers while serving as a lawyer for former President Donald Trump. The filing by Giuliani came a day after a federal judge in Washington, D.C. ordered him to begin paying election workers Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss monetary damages, and 3 days after they filed a new suit seeking to bar him from again defaming the mother and daughter. Right. The U.S. bankruptcy court in Manhattan filing legally pauses for now the $146 million defamation judgment against the former New York City mayor that resulted from a jury verdict last week. Giuliani, while representing Trump in efforts to reverse his loss on the heels of the 2020 election, falsely accused Freeman and Moss of ballot fraud. The claims sparked death threats against them. Their attorney, Michael Gottlieb, in a statement about Giuliani's bankruptcy petition, said this maneuver is unsurprising and it will not succeed in discharging Mr. Giuliani's debt to Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. So maybe it's a little bit tactical from his perspective.
Yeah, that is kind of a funny situation, right? Like you sue someone and you correctly you've been defamed, so you're owed money, but then you can just declare bankruptcy. Like you probably never see the money.
I got no money left. Sorry.
Yeah, it is strange that can happen. I honestly don't remember. I remember the general idea of this story, but I don't remember the specifics of what he said or where he said it or anything. So I'm a little bit out of the loop on this story, but yeah, $146 million. That's a massive defamation suit. That's enormous.
It's cha-ching. Yeah. Well, it says here, Giuliani's filing estimates he has assets worth between $1 million and $10 million, and estimated current liabilities of between $100 million and $500 million. A worksheet in the filing lists his current actual debts at $151.8 million, which most of it is as a result of this case.
Okay.
$146 million defamation judgment. So, yeah, that's really all it is. It's just, like, completely crushed. While the defamation judgment is the lion's share of that total debt, Giuliani also declared he has nearly $1 million in debt to the IRS and New York State Department of Taxation and Finance for unpaid taxes, and that he owes several million in debts to various law firms. Yeah, interesting. Giuliani was sued in September by his former lawyer, Robert Costello, for $1.36 million in unpaid legal fees dating back to late 2019.
Jeez.
Filers used Chapter 11 of the bankruptcy code to reorganize their debts and come up with a plan to pay their creditors. His bankruptcy lawyers, in a statement on Thursday, said, "The filing should be a surprise to no one. No person could have reasonably believed that Mayor Giuliani would be able to pay such a high punitive amount from the defamation case," the attorneys said. Quote, "Chapter 11 will afford Mayor Giuliani the opportunity and time to pursue an appeal while providing transparency for his finances under the supervision of the bankruptcy court to ensure all creditors are treated equally and fairly throughout the process." So it seems like this is just the beginning, but yeah, it sounds as though he's been handed this smackdown in terms of having to pay $146 million in defamation, damages, and that's toppled him, and now he's declared bankruptcy as a bit of a pause tactic, but I have no idea what will happen from here.
Yeah, I don't know.
No idea.
Sounds like he hasn't paid anyone in a while. He hasn't paid his taxes. He didn't pay his lawyer. He didn't.
Sounds that way, doesn't it, Hamish? It definitely sounds that way. Yes.
But yeah. I'm not sure what else to say on this. It's just kind of a funny story.
Yeah. Don't say things that aren't true. That's the lesson to take away from this.
Yeah.
Don't defame people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. There you go, eh? There you go. All right, Hamish, back over to you.
All right. Let's look at this survey of consumer finances from the Federal Reserve. They do a survey every 3 years, and look at the assets and liabilities and all sorts of things for American households. And there's some Australian data in here that I'll talk about as well. The headline was that 58% of American households now own shares, up from 53% recorded in 2019. And it's actually the highest figure ever recorded since they began the survey in 1989. So the highest percentage of American households own shares than more than ever before.
Wow.
The figure includes shares held directly in retirement accounts, pooled investment funds, and other managed assets. And the data shows how much of an impact COVID has had on retail investors participating in the market. COVID, I think, and I'll talk through some of the specific COVID-related things a little bit later, but certainly since 2019, and partly, I think, as a result of people, you know, staying at home and you know, there being lots of financial events going on, a lot more people have decided to participate in the market. In particular, directly held shares increased from 15% in 2019 to 21% in 2022. And that was the largest increase on record since the beginning of the survey. Mm. The median value of household shares also halved to 15,000 in 2022. Halved to 15,000 in 2022.
Right.
Which may seem, you know, well, what happened to everyone's shares? Well, it's actually likely more indicative of people with less money joining the stock market. So you've kind of got more people at the bottom end of the income spectrum or the income spectrum participating in the market, which brings down that median value.
Would it also just be the fact that 2022 was a bad year for the market? Like the market dropped a fair chunk, so the median value of people's shares also fell?
Yeah, I think that probably plays a role. Yeah, for sure. And then when looking at US households who own shares by household income, we can actually see specifically that there are a lot more people at the lower end of the income spectrum joining the stock market. Every percentile saw an increase in the number of households owning stocks. Of the 80th to 100th percentile, so these are the highest household income, over 90% of households now own shares, which shouldn't be too surprising.
Interesting.
People who have a lot of disposable income tend to look for ways to invest it, so it makes sense. But 90%
is it the chicken or the egg, though? Is it the high disposable income allows them to buy the shares, or are they in the shares that have boosted them up to the 80th to 100th percentile?
It's probably a bit of both. Probably a bit of both, yeah. But 90%, nevertheless, is obviously a very high figure. But even the bottom 29th percentile, now about 18% of those households own shares. So obviously, you know, it's far less. And again, you would expect that if you have less disposable income, then you're going to have less money to invest. But the lower percentiles did see massive increases in the percentage of households owning shares.
That's good.
Which I think is a great thing. I think more people participating in the market, growing their wealth. I'll add a small caveat to this. The last time households were participating this much in directly held shares, so individual shares, was 2001.
Hey, Mish, why you got to bring us down like that?
Which of course was, right around the internet bubble. That's also a feature that does tend to happen, unfortunately, is, when there's these bubbles going on, people talk with their friends and, you know, your Uber driver is talking about shares and everyone's kind of feeling like they don't want to miss out. So there is an element of that, but I think generally speaking, the increase we're seeing now is probably a different thing than the increases that happen kind of cyclically due to speculation. In the last couple of years, there's a lot of new, easy to use apps. Brokerage free trading is pretty new few years. Fractional shares for people who just want to buy pieces of shares and smaller minimum trade amounts. All of those things are fairly new to the market. There's also just more information about shares easily obtainable. I mean, just thinking, investing podcasts, YouTube channels, blogs, all of these things didn't really exist before COVID in a big way. Like the boom of kind of finance and investing information online kind of started in around 2018, 2019. And certainly the last couple of years, it's really blown up. So I'm sure that contributes in a meaningful way as well.
I think the last, like clearly the last 20 years have been massive for stock market accessibility.
Yes.
But particularly I'd say the last five or so have been particularly like big leaps forward in terms of accessibility of investing for most people because of the things you say, the fractional shares, the brokerage, the free brokerage, just the number of brokers out there that are marketing and are pushing features that make it easier than ever before to get started. Now, some of that's deceptive for sure. Some of that's, hey, it's easier. It's never been easier. Come and invest, like lure you in because obviously they charge you a brokerage fee. But generally speaking, I think it's a good trend. And it's never been easier to invest in the stock market. There are so many different ways of doing it now. Yeah. So many different apps, different structures, different this, different that. The accessibility has gone up a lot now that I think about it.
And I think, I think it's just kind of human nature. I think a lot of people, when they first start investing, they are probably not going to do it the right way. They're probably going to speculate a little bit. So if people are speculating with $50 and losing it versus $1,000, $5,000 or even more when they're much older investing for the first time, I think that's a good thing. Like certainly there's certainly an element of people just gambling on the stock market. But I think, some people just need to go through that. Like some people
fail fast.
Yeah, exactly. Some people need to learn, you know, some people need to use options with $50 or something to find out that it's
so they get decimated,
incredibly dangerous. And it's better to lose $50 than to do that, you know, when you're much older with $10,000 and really, you know, making a real dent in your net worth or something like that.
Mm. It's one thing I'm very thankful for, actually, for learning those lessons early.
Yeah.
It's actually what, like, and another instance, this is a bit grim, but in my first year of riding a motorbike, I had a crash. I'm glad that I'm kind of glad. It was a small crash. I didn't really get hurt very much, but I'm glad that that happened to me then because that completely changed how I ride motorbikes, which will probably, you know, hold me in good stead for the future. But it is that kind of, if you start investing and then you kind of mess up and make some mistakes early on, just that's probably a good thing in the long run that you're learning those lessons early.
Yeah.
Because it's much better making those mistakes when you're playing around with $100 than 50 grand.
Yeah. And then just some data comparing U.S. households to Australian households. According to the Organization of Economic Cooperation, U.S. households had 39% of their financial assets in equities, in stocks, in 2022, which is massive. Almost 40% of their financial assets in stocks. Australians, by comparison, have just 18% of their assets in equities. And I think that's likely a result of a couple of factors. One, maybe there's others you can think of, but the two main ones I could think of was superannuation program. So we kind of force people to invest into a basket of assets beyond equities, bonds, infrastructure, property. And then speaking of property, we have an incredibly strong housing market, which for those who do own a home, I'm sure if you've owned a home for at least even just a few years, it's probably grown in value and become a much larger part of your financial assets. And for a lot of people, that's just your biggest investment anyway. That's your nest egg. So I think those are probably the two biggest factors as to why we have such a smaller percentage of assets in equities than the US.
Yeah. I wonder, is superannuation 10% or 12% now? I can't even remember.
Is it 12? I thought it was 9.5, or did they up it from
9.5? Yeah, I think they're upping it. I can't remember superannuation. I wonder what it is. Under the super guarantee, employees have to pay super contributions of 11%
of an
employee's ordinary time earnings. Yep, there you go. So that's, I don't know how that compares around the world, but in Australia, we literally have this retirement account where employees are forced to put 11% of their income into it. So,
and you can't access it until, I think, what is it? It's 65 at the moment, I think, age or something like that. Yeah. So, I think it's generally a good thing.
Yeah. think it's a good thing. Is a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you play the probabilities. Chances are not everyone will make it to that point, but most people will. So it makes sense that we're kind of forced just to chip away a little bit to invest it in our superannuation and have that grow over time.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's really hard for, I think, people to it's kind of understated how hard it is to consistently put away money on your own, like of your own free will to set aside money to invest. It is very difficult. If you've been doing it for a while, then it gets easier because you're just in the habit of doing it. It's you know, you've got everything scheduled and everything, but it is quite a difficult habit to form. So I think that's why superannuation is very good. From like the first time you get a job, you're immediately investing, whether you like it or not. So yeah,
no, it is. It's good. It's good. Yeah, cool. All right, Hamish, do we have any anything else on that?
No, that's it.
No, that's it.
All we got.
All right. Well, let's finish off just with a question or two of Q&A, and then let's bounce out of here. So, as always, if you'd like to ask a Q&A question, guys, leave us a comment on the most recent version of the podcast on YouTube, or you can drop it in the Spotify question box if you would like on Spotify. What one should we do, Hamish?
Yeah, I'll ask you one of these. I'll ask you this one. What is your opinion regarding dividends? You mentioned Apple specifically in this podcast. This must have been from a couple of weeks ago. How does one evaluate a dividend strategy for a company? How should I, as an investor, value different dividend strategies?
I don't have a huge amount to say on dividends. I think dividends are okay. I think just when you're looking at companies, you just have to remember to factor it in. So if you're modeling out that you want to get a 15% return per year and the company pays you a 3% dividend, just make sure that you factor that in, that you're already getting 3% for free just for through the dividend. I think dividends, you know, the thing that I talk about is just to check whether a company should be paying a dividend. Like I really don't get caught up on whether a company does or doesn't pay a dividend. It doesn't really bother me. Yeah. I typically prefer, this is just general bias of mine, I typically prefer internal compounders, the companies that are just taking their cash and have good uses for it, so they're investing it internally back in their own business. So they don't want to pay a dividend because it's better used in it's better off in their hands. So I just make sure that, you know, make sure that if a company is not paying a dividend, their return on invested capital is very high. They are making those good investments.
Yeah.
But apart from that, are there any other things you'd add to that?
That's pretty much everything. The main thing I just look at is the company, you know, producing a higher return on their equity, let's say. You know, if you essentially want the company only, as you said, to be retaining and reinvesting money that they can invest effectively. So maintaining that high return on the equity in the company, and everything else should come out to you as a shareholder. But I don't put any weight on dividends over retained earnings per se. Both of them deliver return to you. It's just in a different form. One is cash, and the other one is in capital appreciation. And the other thing to remember is if you're getting a dividend, you've personally got to allocate that capital. Like, the company is saying, we can't allocate this at whatever, 12% per year or 15% per year. So you have to find another stock or another company to allocate it. So dividends aren't just like, you know, they are cash, they are nice, but, you know, that does push the capital allocation decision to you. Whereas personally, it's kind of nice if the company can reinvest all of their earnings at a 15% return. And the only decision I have to make is to invest in that company. And then they can do those decisions. So yeah
nice. Unless you're an income investor, then you just love dividends because that's what you live off of.
You're
no longer reinvesting, you're just loving life and sipping pina coladas on a beach. All right, Hamish, let me ask you this. How much consideration do you give to tax when making investment decisions? How do you think about tax? It's a pretty hard one. I don't really think about it too much.
I don't think I really do all that much. I mean, Yeah, I don't really think I do all that much. I mean, tax.
I think it's because like we plan on holding companies for a very, very long time. So we're not thinking like, oh, I'm going to hold this for a year and then I'm going to sell it. And then I've got this capital gain, capital loss or whatever it might be. And we've got to think about our tax. I mean, there's definitely like, I don't know how this works all around the world with different tax codes, different countries, but that you can definitely think about timing of capital gains and capital losses in Australia. Capital losses you can lock in and they carry forward indefinitely to offset future capital gains. So there is a strategy there. Yeah. But generally speaking, I mean, you want to have capital gains, right? That's what you're hoping for. Yeah. But I think in terms of how much consideration you give.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd only consider it if I was really like, okay, I need to sell now. But I need to lock in this big gain. How do I best do that to minimize my tax that I need to pay? But
yeah. I guess I don't really consider tax too much because just by nature of the strategy of long-term investing, that's probably one of the best ways you can mitigate your tax, right? So you're not dealing with these short-term capital gains. But other tax considerations, I'll be honest, I just defer to my accountant. If I have to, yeah, I mean, whatever it is, if I have capital gains, if I have capital losses every year, I just say, you know, what's the best thing I should do? And then he tells me because it's his area of expertise. And tax is like this whole, you know, it's a whole beast. It's a whole field in of itself. And it's obviously important to know, you know, a little bit about tax. I generally defer to my accountant for any complex tax stuff.
I think that's honestly a good point to take out of it. Like a lot of us investors are very much the do-it-yourself kind of variety. That's why you know, we're not going to just give our money over to some fund. We do take the time and we invest our money. And that does give us that kind of do-it-yourself mentality. But I think you raise a good point is that if you are concerned about anything to do with tax, just go and see an accountant. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, they're one of the professions where if you get a good accountant, they pay for themselves. Like the fee that they will charge you, well, you say, like, that's definitely in my case. The fee that I charge my accountant is so small compared to what he saves me in tax that it's a no-brainer. Yeah. And plus, I don't have to do the work.
Yeah, it's just math. It's like, you pay me this and I'll save you this. It's like, okay.
All right.
Well, as long as that number's higher than that number.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good deal. So I think, and that's the other thing, like, something I've learned, I used to be very much do it yourself, but I've learned when it comes to tax, get someone to help you out because they will know a lot more than you. And I've also found having a lawyer that knows the letter of the law and says what you can and can't do and how you can structure business and how you can set things up and that sort of thing. Those are two professions that I will pay for every single time.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
All right. Cool. Nice. Let's bounce. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in as per usual. Are we going to have a week off next week? What are we doing next week, Hamish?
I'm not in the country, so I think we'll have
South
a week
Korea.
Off.
South Korea.
Yeah.
I'll call you up, dude.
Yeah.
I'll call you up.
Call me up. I'll be in my like snow jacket, like big.
Hey, guys. No, I hope you have a good time, dude. I hope you have an absolutely awesome trip.
I'm sure I will.
Enjoy your Christmas and New Year's.
You too.
And same goes to everyone out there. Thanks very much for your support this year, guys. We'll be away next week. So we'll say now, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will see you, I guess, early next year.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep. 2024.
We shall. All right. 2024, baby. Let's go. All right, guys, have a good holiday period. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast throughout the year, and we'll see you guys very soon.
See you guys.